I'm Dick Paddock, co-host of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom radio show, The Wake Up Call.
And we're glad you're back. We missed you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, welcome back.
Well, things seem to go along okay. So
yeah, we did okay, but we'd love to have you here.
I'm the blue flannel security blanket.
That's about it.
Emphasis on the blue.
Okay.
So I did say this is WCOM, LP, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro. And the wake-up call begins now.
Yeah.
And I am Dick Paddock, co-host, and sitting across from me is our accustomed co-host, Lori Hoyt. And on the camera up here is Emily O'Hare. She actually was very helpful over the course of the 3 weeks that I was gone.
Indispensable, absolutely. Yes. And we had Iris Schnitzer here. So we're developing a really pretty good team. We're
finally getting a team.
We're getting a team. It's so exciting. Our team.
Right. So today our guest is Wanda Hunter, and I'll let Lori take the rest of the introduction.
Yeah, Wanda Hunter is our guest, and Wanda is, I'm going to let her tell us something about herself, but welcome to the show. But I'll just say I know you from the NAACP.
That's right.
For years you've been coming. I know also that you do, and I think this is a passion of yours, racial diversity programs.
Racial equity.
Equity. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And other than that, I'll let you tell us more about yourself.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm a longtime Chapel Hill, Carrboro resident, going right back to the early 70s. Did my education at UNC and landed in a career being a public health researcher at UNC, which I did for 30 years. And I retired in late 2010. But before retiring, because I did community-based participatory research, I kept hearing from a lot of my colleagues about a wonderful training program with the Racial Equity Institute. And even though I was about to retire, I was so intrigued by the things that people said about this program, about how helpful it was, how life-changing it was, and I guess more to the point, how there was no other training that people had experienced that really helped to explain why we continue to have persistent and growing inequities in every institution we have in America, whether it's education, health, criminal justice, mm-hmm. legal, housing, mm-hmm. employment, nonprofits, you name it. Race is still, the biggest predictor of outcome 50 years after the passage of significant civil rights legislation. And I had worked in the area of racial health disparities. So
okay.
It was something I knew a lot about and cared a lot about.
Yeah.
And I had been involved in sort of countless programs and efforts to try to reduce disparities in health based on race. And none of them were really successful. There might be mild successes, but they weren't sustained successes, or you couldn't take them to scale. And so even at the end of my career, I was very vexed about this problem related to inequities, disparities by race, and was just really curious to learn more about how we might more effectively address that.
So that's what got you started.
It is. So I went to workshop in Greensboro. Uh-huh. The Racial Equity Institute is a group of trainers and organizers that are based in Greensboro, North Carolina. And so I went there to participate in this training. And I found it, I just found it to be sort of the most scintillating, stimulating, interesting, and potentially helpful training I had ever participated in. And I'd had a career of going to diversity workshops and even workshops about, all the different oppressions and isms. But this workshop really brought a new analysis and a new way of looking at things that I found to be so interesting and useful that I couldn't stop thinking about it. I thought I really needed to engage in it more deeply to better understand it. And more importantly, I really wanted people who I knew and cared about, people who I worked with, my family, my friends, my church. I wanted other people to experience that with me so mm-hmm. we could sort of engage this new kind of learning together. Mm-hmm. So I got together a group of people, and we organized a workshop in Chapel Hill, and that was in January 2011. So it was right after I retired in December 2010, and we organized a workshop in January 2011, brought the Racial Equity Institute here to do it, and was just counting up the other day, we have done 50 workshops in this area since that first workshop in wow. January 2011.
So you retired in December, and would you allow yourself a week off? Because
I was very excited about that. Yeah. I mean, I was very excited, and so, yeah. You know,
gives
while...
you energy.
Yeah,
you
it does. It does. When you're excited, you get energy.
Enthusiasm, yeah. So you started doing... So that's one of your main... ways that you contribute to the community of these workshops?
Yeah, so that was the beginning, and we started doing the workshops. But one of the things that our trainers say and that we like to say is that we don't just train for training purposes alone. We train in order to organize for change. Mm-hmm. And that's what the training is about. So mm-hmm. it's to give an analysis and to give tools about how we can more effectively organize mm-hmm. for change and really confront this racial status quo that is shameful, really. You know, we have a shameful history around race in our country. and in many ways, you know, even though, you know, people might want to say, you know, we don't see race or we're in a post-racial society, you know, as I said earlier, race is still the determinant of every outcome. And I think people don't really know what to do because we can't even understand what racism looks like in its contemporary manifestation, mm-hmm. you know, in the 21st century mm-hmm. USA. And so this training is just, the reason we've had 50 trainings is because the trainings are so extraordinarily useful and helpful. And we don't just set up a training and advertise it, as people demand the training, and so we set it up to mm-hmm. meet the need. And so we started the trainings in Chapel Hill. We had so many people coming from Durham that a new training team organizing group got organized in Durham, and they started doing workshops there. Then it's expanded to Raleigh. So now we have a triangle-wide training and organizing program that we called Organizing Against Racism North Carolina. So,
Okay. So
we're organizing out of the training.
So the training, I imagine there's all kinds of people come.
Absolutely.
Like teachers, policemen.
Absolutely. Yes. Mayors, council. Yeah. So we have people coming from all over the triangle, from all walks of life, from people who are governmental officials to heads of institutions. We've had, you know, many, many people come from the Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools. We have institutions that are trying to send almost all of the people in their institution to get trained. And so, mm-hmm. You know, Teach for America, Habitat for Humanity, MDC, UNC. You know, a really interesting thing that has come out of our organizing is that so many people were coming from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, you know, my old stomping ground, that we had graduate students, a lot of graduate students and faculty and staff coming. And one of the comments that we got more than once was that we're preparing students in the university to go out and work in these institutions where race is the biggest predictor of outcome, and yet we're not educating them about race and racism mm-hmm. at all. It's almost as if we think, by virtue of living in this country, that we all understand race and racism, mm-hmm. and what I've grown to know over the last 5 years is how poorly we do mm-hmm. understand it, because I think our socialization is such that we, you know, are really not meant to see, you know, a lot of our history in the way that race has been structured, and especially about the way that it's been structured to advantage white people. It's very easy to see oppression. It's not as easy to see the advantage that we white people
white
get.
Privilege. That's all of us. I mean, we have blind spots even when you think you're paying attention.
Yeah.
It's just so easy to miss That's the oppression we can see, but that white privilege, and I imagine that part of that training would be a big focus to help people look within and get aware of the advantages they have with they are white.
Yes, and it's not just at a personal level. It's really at a historical, structural, and institutional level.
Yes.
Because I think one of the things that, you know, when you think about the history, and so a big part of our workshop, our workshop is not a touchy-feely workshop. It's not a workshop about personal racism.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, it's not about that at all. We think that one of the mistakes that, you know, we as a society have made in trying to address racism is that we come at it from the perspective of let's all get along, let's mm-hmm. have better racial relations. I think we've made great gains in that area.
Mm-hmm.
We also, you know, say, well, we value diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we do value diversity, but if you put people of color in a diverse situation in order to make it diverse, but we haven't really addressed the underlying issues of white power and privilege
mm-hmm.
and advantage, we may be further oppressing people of color by putting them in the diverse
situation.
So diversity alone is not the answer.
No.
You know, we really need to understand, the historical nature of racism, which has been one. So we do look a lot at data in this workshop, and we look a lot at history. And if you look at, and for me, and I felt like I knew a lot about history, and I learned how much I didn't know. But when we look at the history of our country and we look at the construction of race, which happened in the 1600s, and the race that was constructed was white. And white was constructed in order to decide who in these new colonies were going to have privilege and power and ownership
mm-hmm.
and be able to vote and all of those things, and they were assigned to a made-up race of people called white.
Mm-hmm.
And that has had tremendous ramifications through our history. And when you think about our history, it is really a history of white affirmative action that's gone all the way up until the 60s, where advantages, special perks, special opportunities were assigned to a group of people according to race, and that race was white.
Mm-hmm.
And the accumulation of all of that advantage and privilege from the 1600s right up until the 1960s has been like, well, I mean, just think about if you were playing Monopoly with a group of people and let's say, you know, the white group of people got to play Monopoly for 2 or 3 hours, and then after 2 or 3 hours you invited people of color to come in and play with you. Well, what would the Monopoly board look like at that point? Where is the advantage? Where is the opportunity?
How many hotels do you already have?
What can you buy? What can you buy? Because
what's left?
Right, because the ownership, you know, and in very real ways, you know, ownership, land and ownership, you know, have been rights that have been accorded to white people for so long that the structures are in place. It's very, very difficult. Would be very difficult to win a game of Monopoly if you came in 3 hours into the game.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so you can already predict who the winners are going to be. We already know who our institutions were created for. Up until the 50s and the 60s, by law, people of color couldn't even access our institutions. But we don't call UNC a historically white university because it was just the university. And so when we look at UNC and we see who's there and what the outcomes look like, we kind of forget the fact that up until very recently, only white people even had access to this university.
Well, and actually women had a tough time too.
Exactly.
Because I started going sort of later in life as an undergraduate in the late 60s, and they had just recently been letting women in.
Yeah, me too.
they had Greensboro, the Women's College,
that's
and
right.
You could transfer in your junior year,
yes.
but the first 2 years, so that it was predominantly 3/4 guys and maybe 1/4 women. And it's so interesting now how that whole ratio has reversed. But
it really has.
You don't have to look very far back to see how things were so skewed. And if as a white woman, I can remember that for, as a personal thing, for blacks, I think one of my, I was in the School of Social Work after I finished undergraduate here, and I think one of my teachers, Hortense McClinton, was one of the first black professors hired.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was not that long ago.
No,
you know, so people think, oh, well, slavery, that's so long ago, neglecting to realize all the Jim Crow laws that, and even though it was predominantly and worse in the South, the North was not the best place either. There's the GI Bill discriminated against black GIs when they were building all those houses.
That's right.
On Long Island, I think they had Levittown, was a whole big,
that's right,
very cute houses for returning GIs after the Second World War. And I did not know that until recent years.
Yeah.
That a friend lived there. She said, oh, yeah, they kept blacks out.
Yeah. We talk about that in the workshop. We actually watch part of a documentary you might be familiar with called Race, the Power of an Illusion. It's an excellent documentary. I recommend it to everyone.
Yeah.
But it's a three-part documentary that's sort of the history of race in our country. And
The
last part is about how sort of the policies and social structures and the institutions that got set up around race. And there's a lot of discussion of the GI Bill and the Social Security Act and even Levittown. They interview a lot of people from Levittown. But, you know, the GI Bill was a huge affirmative action program for white people because the GI Bill gave people free education, you know, access to housing, access to job training, and while all of it looked race neutral on the face of it, none of it ended up being race neutral at all because of just the way policies were set up in the country at that time. There was redlining, and so housing wasn't race neutral.
Yeah.
While GIs could go to college free of charge, in the 50s, the late 40s and the 50s, what was the racial climate for who could go to what college?
Mm-hmm.
You know, black GIs could not go to our historically white institutions, and so there were very few medical schools or professional training programs, and so there was the educational opportunities were just very limited, you know, and what HBCUs could provide.
Mm-hmm.
Even in terms of job training, when the GIs came out of the war, the job counselors were trained to help them find jobs that were similar to the jobs that they had had in the war. But because barracks had been segregated, there were very particular kinds of jobs that were not available to GIs. You know, they ended up working in kitchens and as custodians, and when they came home, that was the job training. Those were the jobs that they got directed
to. And I wonder if a lot of young people realized that the military was not integrated till after the war.
That's right.
I think it was Truman. So that
that's right.
A lot of young people, you know, they, I'm sure, don't realize
right.
how recent a lot of the so-called, or they are gains, but how recent they are. And you're right about that's a great analogy about the Monopoly game coming
a couple
of hours later, and Boardwalk is gone and all
I
the,
know.
You know.
I know. Did you know that during World War II that the American Red Cross segregated blood?
I think I had heard that, and I'd forgotten that. And that's a lot of it. You can easily forget. Yeah.
So the blood bank itself was developed and made possible by a black physician, Dr. Charles Drew. Mm-hmm. And so he made the technology possible in order for people to be able to receive blood. And yet white soldiers objected to the idea of getting what they called black blood. Mm-hmm. And the American Red Cross went right along with that and segregated blood. You know, and there was something called, there's a new book out that I haven't read yet, but I've heard a lot of people talking about it. It's called The Double V. And the double V stands for the fact that in the during World War II, after two world wars in which black GIs went to battle to fight for their country, fight to defend a country in which they were oppressed every day and denied access to all of the good American institutions, and yet they went to fight in this war, and they felt like by virtue of, you know, being on front lines and, you know, putting their lives, you know, sacrificing their lives for the good of the country, that this might be the end to Jim Crow segregation, and that they would be able to have a double victory, a victory not only abroad, yeah, but a victory at home, where finally, you know, their humanity would be recognized, right, by white America. But it backfired terribly, and there were white people who said, like, how dare they use this war to try to, you know, criticize conditions at home. This is no time to criticize conditions at home. And so not only did they not have a double victory, but it really backfired. And I'm sure you've heard about when GIs came home, and if black GIs were even wearing their uniforms, it made them a target for attack.
And that is so infuriating and heartbreaking.
Yeah.
You know, the, yeah. And I don't know if it was more in the South, but I would not be surprised if it was in the North, too.
No, I think it was everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere.
Yeah, I think it was everywhere.
Like, don't you dare get up.
We definitely had our own very particular problems in the South, and I don't want to deny that. But,
yeah,
you know, another thing that I think is not really widely understood is, you know, how much even slavery, while it was a Southern institution, it was an institution that supported the entire country. There were slaves in every state in the Union, but even for people who didn't have slaves, everyone, the economy,
profited.
The whole American economy was run on the back of kidnapped and enslaved African people.
You know, and I think it's just in recent years that I have just read more and understood how much of that, you know, I'd heard, the building the slave ships,
mm-hmm,
up in, right, New England, mm-hmm, they were making money, and mm-hmm, some, and they were
the banks,
the slave
all the
trade.
Banks were there, right?
But
yeah,
but, mm-hmm, but in more recent years, I've just read how deeply ingrained. In fact, the whole economy. I just was reading something recently. The whole economy was on the backs of slavery.
That's exactly right.
You know, slavery and cotton and the whole. It's just even thinking I pay attention to these things more than maybe, mm-hmm, some people,
mm-hmm,
the extent of it and how pervasive and how every, mm-hmm, bit of our economy was affected by that.
Every bit. You're
so
right.
When blacks talk about, you know, this nation was built on our backs, it's not just, you know,
it's not just rhetoric.
That they laid the cobblestones or the bricks here at UNC. It's
that's
the
right.
The whole nation, and
exactly
I just
right.
think the extent of that. It's just in recent years that has really, and I hear what you're saying that, mm-hmm, it's so important in a course like that to see the institutional part of it, mm-hmm, how. A view of history is just, mm-hmm, to go, mm-hmm, back and really dig, mm-hmm, out those facts, mm-hmm, that we conveniently, mm-hmm, never heard of.
That's right. Yeah, I think we get taught a pretty skewed history. It's incomplete and it's biased toward patriotism and, mm-hmm, you know, love of country and not to criticize the, you know, decisions.
But
that
more
we
so even than. You might have realized even when you thought you knew
that's
a lot
right.
about it. You know,
that's exactly right. You
think you know so much, and then there's something else comes up, and you lose your breath is taken away again.
Yeah.
Like oh my God. Well, just recently in recent times, with Tim Tyson's getting us to look at that in Wilmington in 1998. Mm-hmm. 1898. It wasn't a race riot. It was a coup d'etat.
Yeah.
You know, and that Josephus Daniels, that the News and Observer was a prime instigator of stirring up this fear of the black man. And You know, all of this is just sort of, and that's where history is so important, is historians bringing that to light.
Yeah.
And to the point that the News and Observer had a big, mm-hmm. I know you were here then, I'm sure, a big apology, and they had a whole special edition with the whole history of that.
Of the Wilmington 10.
Of the mm-hmm. Wilmington yeah. Coup d'etat, the Wilmington.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not the Wilmington 10. That's a different thing.
The Wilmington 10's another.
Oh, yeah. Right. No, the 18. Okay, yeah, yes, okay, yeah.
I'm talking about the coup d'etat in
1898.
Right. To know that Wilmington was the biggest, most important
city in the state,
and that it wasn't Raleigh. Wilmington was the big, and they had their fusion.
Fusion party
program with the whites and blacks working together successfully, and boy, the racist people in this state could not stand it.
No,
and so by terrorism, they went and murdered everybody and declared a victory. So are we ready for a station break?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, time flies especially when you get onto history and race.
We're already at the bottom of the hour. Okay. This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show, our wake-up call to you. And we are being brought to you on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And it's a 100-watt station, so you might have a little difficulty picking it up if you're more than 5 inches away from the transmitter. So we offer access through the internet. If you go to wcomfm.org, you can find a button there that will allow you to link up to us and give you really good reception as long as you've got a really good computer. One of the things we need to do is to do a promotion to try and get some money for the radio station.
Okay, this radio station, folks, is just like WILPF and the NAACP. It's volunteer-run and always needs some help and financial help.
For 10 years, your community radio station, WCOM LP 103.5, has been a nonprofit, all-volunteer community radio station serving Carrboro and Chapel Hill. WCOM can only do this with the support of the community. Please go to the aforementioned WCOMFM.org right now and make your safe, secure online donation through PayPal to keep your station strong. Remember, it is your station. Or you can drop a check in the mail if you wish to WCOM-FM, 300G East Main Street, Carrboro, North Carolina, 27510. Whether big, little, or in the middle, every donation matters. So please drop that piece of paper in the mail or get those electrons moving in our direction through PayPal so that we can have money to keep our station going.
Yeah, let's remind ourselves we really need to make a contribution, too, because we're so happy to be here. We've been here having our radio show for, about 7 years now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we're so grateful to the station to have this opportunity and to bring wonderful people from the community, from the progressive community, from different aspects of things that are happening, and to get them to tell their story and their passion here. So we've got to remember to do what we're asking other people to do. I'm saying this to myself, reminding myself.
Right.
You know. And I was just thinking of announcements, and let's not let you get away before we talk about the upcoming racial equity forum, educational forum coming up.
Sure.
Maybe we should just talk about that now. We can repeat about that September 26th.
Okay. Yeah, so with Organizing Against Racism North Carolina, I said that, you know, we not only train, but we train for organizing for transformation, working specifically with institutions, in our own local areas. And so, a couple of the institutions that we've been working with here locally are both our local law enforcement agencies, and we've recently been part of a coalition that has made some recommendations around reform for law enforcement. And we also have a group of people who are, again, working in coalition or NC, along with NAACP and other social justice institutions in town, have been coming together to work with the Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools to continue to investigate the disparities that exist in our school system, long-time disparities around the achievement gap, disproportionate discipline, disproportionate participation in special classes, whether they're advanced classes or special education classes. And we, you know, coming out of ORNC, you know, we have, as I said, a special analysis that we bring to problems of institutional racism. And so working with our partners, our colleagues here, we're putting together a report this summer with some recommendations that we're going to bring to the administration and to the Board of Education, you know, which they're looking forward to. And then the NAACP, again, working with colleagues, will be sponsoring a community forum. I'm going to pull up my calendar. It's in late September.
I think September 26th is what was talked about at the retreat.
Then I'm sure you're right.
Unless they change it.
That's exactly right. So it's September 26th. It'll be at Northside Elementary School. Cool. And I think the time's to be announced, but we're looking at a 3 or 4 hour forum in the afternoon.
Yeah. 1 to 4 is what I think they.
And the recommendations will be out and available in early September. So, you know, they will be there, and the administration and school board will have received them. And then this will be a time for the community to come together with some panels to look at these together as a community and to, you know, think about what it is we really need, if there's some new and different strategies that we might be looking at mm-hmm. as a school system in order to, you know, keep moving and making great strides toward equity, because we think that it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
We really do. And so that's, you know, that's just one of our organizing efforts that we have going on. And if you don't mind, I'd like to also let your listeners know about when the next Racial Equity Institute workshop
sure.
will be here, too.
Sure.
So that one is going to be, the next one in Chapel Hill will be August 31st, September 1st. So they're always 2 back-to-back days. And we have a website. It's oarnc.org. Or, so it stands for Organizing Against Racism North Carolina, .org. And on that website, you can go online and learn about, you know, all of our programs, and you can register for upcoming workshops that we have now in Chapel Hill, in Durham, and in Raleigh.
So the next one will be August 31st.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And then what will it be at your church?
That one is at United Church of Chapel Hill, and then the one that we're going to have after that will be in November, and that one will be at the Hargrave Center. So
okay.
we use both locations here in Chapel Hill.
Okay. Dick?
Yeah, I've got a couple more announcements.
Okay.
First, we gave the website for the radio show, but we did not give the website for WILF. That's triangle,
hey,
WILF.
We got to toot our own horn a little bit better, don't we?
Right. Yeah, that's triangle, WILF.org. And I'm going to plug something.
Well, before you plug something else, let me just, I think we got to mention this each time, that this is our, internationally and nationally, it's our 100th birthday, started in 1915, by Jane Addams, that early social worker. I think she sort of started the profession of social work. And locally, relation, but Charlotte Addams started it here 80 years ago in 1935. So,
right.
So that's something we're going to be talking about, and we're going to be having a big celebration in November that everybody will be invited to. And, wanted to put another plug in?
Yes. Another effort on education and anti-racism work, the Southern Anti-Racism Network, which is, has a website, projectsarn.org. is having a follow-up to our very successful conversation that we had, with Bert Lahm of the Superintendent of Schools over in Durham, and we're going to have a follow-up forum and conversation on next steps in education and racism, and that's going to be the 10th of September, and it will be in the Durham Public Library, main branch in the auditorium, and there will be refreshments served.
Okay, and then
I'm sorry, and I forgot to say 6 p.m.
6 p.m.
Durham September 10th.
September 10th. Okay, and then Emily handed me a note, reminded me, and thank you. We had Minister Campbell on last week, and he is so enthusiastic about their new Rogers Road Community Center. It's only 6 months since it's opened, and they're going full steam ahead with a whole summer program. They have anywhere from 50 to 80 kids coming every day. They also depend on volunteers and a lot of love. Last week they were having a sleepover out in their field right next door. For a lot of the kids, it's the first time they've ever done that, sleeping outside, looking up at the stars, singing songs. And the big thing that he's very excited about, this is, they do it every year. It's absolutely wonderful. They pull together a back-to-school bash. And last year and this year, they're going to be handing out 550 school bags filled with, for the elementary school, what the teachers want them to bring, what pencils, paper, what, there's a list I know mothers get that's, kids to be pretty darn expensive, and then for the middle school kids what they need, and then the high school kids. So they are so well organized. So that is going to be on Saturday, August 8th, and the kids go over to the church that's in that neighborhood, Oasis of Love Church, first, and some program goes on there, and then they walk on the few blocks over to the community center. And if you see the look on those kids' faces, especially the little kids showing each other their book bags, they're so excited. And then there's going to be a big, food and games, and it's just a great celebration. Parents come. So that's not a cheap thing to pull together. I don't know how they do it every year, but they do it. Donations are welcome. So to go to do you have down, Rena? You could just go to the website.
Right.
Rena stands for the Rogers Eubanks
Neighborhood Association.
Thank you. Neighborhood Association, and you can just go over there. It's right in the Rogers Road community, right off Rogers Road on Edgar Street,
and
Purefoy. And a good turn right on Purefoy, and it's on Purefoy and Edgar. It's a beautiful building, and you can drop off there every day, drop off donations. Money is always particularly welcome, but if you have school supplies and you saw a good sale on some stuff, bring that. So it's a real community celebration. It's been 40 years to get this community center, so it's being well used and well enjoyed. So think about making a donation there. That would be great. And come and celebrate with the community.
Yeah, welcome visitors.
Yeah, anytime. And that's August 8th, from about 12 to 3, I think, or 4 will be. So a lot going on. It's a very, but a lot of these things are connected again with race and race issues. And, with Rogers Road, it was the environmental aspect of racial lack of equity, mm-hmm. that it's always these poor neighborhoods where they want to put landfills or fracking or whatever the latest manifestation is things that nobody wants in their backyard. Mm-hmm. They always find the backyards of the poor and people of color. And but this is one that they fought and organized and have gotten a modicum of justice.
That's right.
So back where we our guest today is Wanda Hunter, who has been working, doing workshops on racial equity ever since she retired in 2011. And has done 50 workshops, and another one is coming up August 28th. You can sign up. It's not too late, and another one in November.
That's right.
And so we've been talking about that a lot of times when people think about race, they think of personal prejudice, and we're just beginning to be educated to think of it in terms of the structural, deeply rooted institutional racism that is ongoing still today, unfortunately, and that does more damage than any personal animosity, although they all go together. But even when you think you've gotten beyond, and oh yes, we're going to get along well together, you know, we see more and more blacks in restaurants, and you know, they're part of our regular life now. But there is still so much institutionalized and so much unrecognized white privilege that those of us who are white, even when we're trying to pay attention, it can creep up and bite you. That you can easily forget or not notice. So,
well, so one thing that I was thinking about, you and Dick were talking about the fusion movement in the late 1800s in Wilmington, and then Dick was also talking about what the Southern Anti-Racist Network is doing in educational forum in Durham, and so, you know, one of our goals, you know, in addition to training, as I said, we're training because we're organizing for change. We don't want to be organizing in isolation. We want to be part of a modern-day fusion movement, which I think is, you know, one of the things that Reverend Barber and the Moral Monday movement has been about, is that we can't separate ourselves into separate silos seeking different areas of social justice, because they all overlap, and we don't need to be working across purposes. So we really look to become part of a larger movement, you know, for justice, you know, for equity, you know, joining together, you know, joining our group. So we have a group that is an Organized Against Racism group that's active in Durham, or Durham. And, you know, and they, too, are concerned with schools and working with Spirit House and other groups. So I just think that, you know, one of our challenges in this day is to find each other, you know, to find our common ground and join together in a movement, which I think that, you know, Moral Monday's been so successful at, you know, doing it on a statewide level. But on a local level, you know, we need to be doing that, too, bringing people together around the interest of the common welfare.
And the President Obama always tries so often to get that idea across, that, you know, being your brother's keeper. Dick, so you might want to get some contact name and number from Wanda for that local equity group in Durham.
And I can reciprocate.
Or you can pass yours over to her.
And we are, so also you were talking about the radio being run by volunteers. So when I talked about the work that we've done for 4.5 years now with racial equity training, and then out of the training, we do pull people back together. So we are growing a large network, a large collective movement that comes together monthly in lots of ways, you know, in caucuses to continue to deepen and strengthen our own knowledge and analysis and resolve, and relationships, because relationships are very important to be able to work for change. You know, we know from the civil rights movement that people didn't just go to a march, you know, they didn't just put their lives on the line without having sort of deeply held relationships that it made it possible for people to be courageous and to sort of step out. And so So we're about developing deep relationships, developing a deep knowledge and understanding and analysis and coalitions, you know, across, you know, certainly across the state to be working for racial justice. I mean, we really believe, I mean, I've come to believe that race is at the bottom of almost everything that ails us as a nation. You just scratch it and race is there. And how could it not be? Because as you said, Lori, we wouldn't even be a country had we not kidnapped and enslaved African people and had their free labor to build our economy. You know, and we continue to build our economy on free and cheap labor, whether it's Latino immigrants, whether it's China. You know, we continue to do that. And I think this kind of self-examination, you know, of our country and of our economic ways. And so racism, of course, overlaps with capitalism, and it's mm-hmm. connected to sexism. I mean, all of these, mm-hmm. you know, there's racism is kind of the glue that holds all of these isms together. Mm-hmm. And if you just start looking at it carefully, you know, you can see how that's true. And so it's, you know, it's one reason that we all just need to come together and really, you know, when you think about, you know, when we think about affirmative action, we don't think about white affirmative action, even though that has been the history of our country. You know, for most of the history of our country, we had laws that said only white people can do it. By race, you get this advantage. When we tried to do that for just a little while, you know, to try to help a group
and
of...
Look at the furor.
That's right. Look,
oh, my gosh.
Look at the furor. Yeah. And then when we think about even what that affirmative action program was able to accomplish, who were the biggest beneficiaries? White women. White women were the biggest beneficiaries, and by extension, white families were the biggest beneficiaries. So who really benefited from that affirmative action? You know, you could make a case that even white people
managed to take over whatever.
Exactly. So anyway, I think, you know, there's a lot of work to do, and I think that, you know, one of the reasons that we haven't been successful is we work in silos, but we also have, you know, different definitions or understanding of what racism is or exactly how we need to mm-hmm. attack it or approach it. Mm-hmm. And so we're just really, you know, pulling for a movement where we all come together with some common definitions, some common understandings and analysis, and work together. So we've been building this movement now for 4 years, and, you know, we've trained more than 2,000 people, and we probably have more than 100 or so people who are very active in the Triangle area, and we've been doing all this work by volunteer mm-hmm. effort. And one of the things that we've learned is that we really believe in the leadership of people of color in this movement. We think that, you know, number one, racism was invented by white people, and I think that white people like me and you and Dick, you know, that we all need to be standing up for racial justice. We don't need to be going out and trying to lead people of color, though. We don't need to be going out and even trying to necessarily help people of color, because I think when we do that, it still puts us in mm-hmm. a hierarchical position mm-hmm. as the helpers. So our movement is about elevating the leadership of people of color while white people also stand up for justice mm-hmm. and lead their own movement for mm-hmm. racism. But we found that if we have a movement that's all volunteer, that who are the people who end up being able to be volunteers? They're people like me, you know, materially privileged people who are retired, who have time to give, and yet we have so many talented leaders of color who would like to be at the forefront, but they can't afford to be volunteers. Mm-hmm. And so we have to think about movements that are led by volunteers and what that ends up doing too
yeah.
in terms of just reinforcing the status quo.
Yeah.
So we're in the process of moving from a volunteer-led organization to being a nonprofit with staff. And we've just hired our first executive director. She is a community leader and organizer in Durham. Her name is Cameron Smith. And
This is news.
Yeah. Well, it is kind of hot off the press because we've just
hot off the press.
We've just hired Cameron, you know, this month, and so now we are actively going to be seeking funding and donations.
Yeah. And what was her last name, Cameron?
Cameron Smith.
Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yeah, she works. She has been working with an organization called Neighborhood Allies, and it's about assets-based community development, and that is sort of part of the work that we're doing in ORNC. So we're just really excited to have Cameron, who's been helping to lead the Durham organizing group for ORNC for quite some time anyway, and we just feel really lucky to be able to hire her. But we will be, you know, actively looking for support for the work that we're doing to be able to pay our local community organizers to do this very critical work.
Are you going to try to get some grants to get
we
it started?
Are. We are. Yeah. We definitely are. We're working on that right now.
Yeah. Well, that's a great idea, and that's a good point that volunteers can be fine, like with us being retired. You know, I couldn't do it
all
when
of us.
I was,
right.
Couldn't do it when I was still working, and not, especially not on a social worker income. So that's very thoughtful to think about that, then, especially to get some of the younger women.
We don't want to be replicating the same the same setup even within our organizing against racism, and so. So, one of the things that we're doing all the time is trying to even analyze the way that we come together, and work in ways that promote equity and justice and don't allow people of privilege to still dominate an organization like ours.
Well, I know, like, you know, Reverend Campbell is still working, and I know that's really hard for him. So it takes people with unusual energy, or maybe not having small children at home, to be able to do volunteer work, black or white, when you're still working. But I think his kids are getting a little bit bigger now.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Not needing quite the care. But that's a great idea to think in those terms, especially getting some younger people of color.
Yes.
Well, they have all that great energy.
Yes, and just people who have organizing skills. So
yeah.
I'm a co-chair of our board, but the other co-chair is Stephanie Perry, who I think you know. So she's a local Orange County organizer. She is a person of color. And, with terrific organizing skills. And so she has been at the forefront of a lot of the organizing that we've been doing here in our own county.
Mm-hmm.
And another exciting thing that's happening, so one of our goals relates to building collective economics for communities of color, because racism at bottom, as you said yourself, was an economic system, and it still operates as an economic system. And we know even here in our own community that we once had a vibrant black business district right here in this area, you know, that no longer exists. And so because of the way that racial opportunity has been structured, even in the days of integration, black businesses have not been able to thrive. It's very hard to start a new business. It's hard to sufficiently capitalize a new business. Mm-hmm. And so this is another part of our organizing strategy, is to think about how we help launch and support and sufficiently capitalize new black-owned businesses here in our communities. And so the first one that we are launching is a business owned by Stephanie Perry called Sweetie's Catering. And so it is Southern and vegan catering, and it's sort of catering with the conscience, catering for the community, and a lot of people.
And what was the first word before?
Sweetie.
Stephanie
learned to cook from her grandmother. Her grandmother's name was Sweetie. So she named her business after her grandma, Sweetie.
Oh.
And so And so when
is she doing it out of her home right now?
Or she actually has a kitchen. She just got a kitchen, and so it's one of the it's one of our first businesses where we will be looking for community support to help launch and help make sustainable this brand new business in our community that a lot of people are, you know, getting to enjoy. People of Faith Against the Death Penalty have a big event on Friday night, and Stephanie will be catering that. But she caters all of our workshops, so our workshops provide a big catering opportunity because we're having several a month, and so that was the way that we helped Stephanie get going. She has a history of being a caterer and being a chef, and so so this was sort of a long dream of hers to be able to have her own business.
So,
and
it's not just sweet goods, in spite of her grandma's
name. She is a gourmet chef and can do anything. If people are at the PFADP event on Friday night to honor Steve Deere, who's been the longtime director of People of Faith Against the Death Penalty, it's open to the community. And
is that this Friday night?
It's Friday night.
I thought they were having it in November. Oh, so this Friday night?
It's Friday.
Where is that going to be?
At United Church.
At United Church.
And I think it's at 7. That's my memory. My calendar doesn't say, but I think it's at 7.
The thing you're thinking of is the annual PFADP banquet. Which we were anticipating celebrating with Stephen.
Yes, and that's going to be, because we were trying to set our banquet so we didn't interfere.
Yeah.
So this is going to be the 15th. Yes. So I knew about that, but I didn't know about this Friday.
Yes, well, it's kind of a farewell party and to honor Steve, because he and his family are going to be moving and leaving the community.
We had a potluck, Wilf did, honoring Steve about a month ago. Yeah, so this is his organization is having, the People of Faith is
Yes, so the board and other supporters of PFADP are holding this event on Friday night.
Oh, neat, We have a tape of Steve that we want to get on the People's Channel, because he was really, knowing that he was retired, and he was just so funny. We got the biggest kick, so we got to get that ready to put on the People's Channel, as well as to replay it here. So she's going to cater that.
She'll be catering that. So for people who are there, they'll get a chance to sample her very delicious cooking.
What's on the menu? We've got to be doing some catering. Yeah. The
good news, as far as I'm concerned, is that it's vegan.
Yeah.
Since I'm a vegetarian, that very helpful.
Friday night will not be all vegan or vegetarian, but she can do that. And so even when we have our workshops, we always make sure that we have vegetarian offerings and vegan offerings, gluten-free offerings, and Stephanie is
for
just
every palate.
She is just so talented at doing anything. So it's going to be a wonderful resource for our community.
Oh, that's really good to know. I did not know that either. So, boy, Dick just gave me the signal. We have 2 more minutes. Is there any last thing that you wish you had remembered that you want to put out your website again for?
Yes, so the website for Organizing Against Racism North Carolina is oarnc.org. And we right now are a tri-county organization that sponsors trainings and building a collective movement to organize against racism, including a movement to build economic power in Black communities.
Well, that's really expanded now with this entrepreneurial part of it. This is very interesting.
So one of the things we'll be doing in the next year is just publishing a resource guide to Black-owned businesses in Wake, Orange, and Durham counties, because we think it's not only important to be developing new Black businesses, but to be supporting the ones that we have in our
that we already have. Yeah. Well, Wanda, it's been great having you here.
Thank you so much
always,
for giving me the opportunity to come and talk.
Always learn more. You think you know a little bit about somebody or what they're doing, but it's always good to go into more depth. thank you for the work that you do for this community.
Thank you for the work you do.
Yeah, and...
I want to stick in a couple of little announcements here. First is, following our show, is North Carolina Policy Watch.
Yes.
News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon.
Yes.
And this evening at 7 o'clock, there's going to be a Bernie Sanders Feel the Burn event over at the Carrboro Farmers Market.
Town Hall.
At 7 o'clock. And supposedly he will start speaking to all of us at 7:30.
It's going to be a live video. And we should mention again, I've been told we've got to mention names more often. So Wanda Hunter is who we've been talking to. And I'm Lori Hoyt, and you're Dick Patrick.
I'm Dick Patrick.
And that's Emily O'Hare. And because somebody said, you know, you talking and you're coming in the middle, you wonder, who is that? And I'm just trying to train myself.